everybody. I'm Zoe.
And I'm Chandi.
And this is Bound by the Cloak. Today, we're taking a trip down memory lane to the bright lights and big prizes of TV's longest-running game show, The Price is Right. And we're not just reminiscing about The Price is Right, but our guest today knows the game like nobody else. Ted Slauson gained notoriety for his remarkable knowledge and frequent appearances on The Price is Right. He became known for his study of the show's pricing games, allowing him to predict the outcomes with uncanny accuracy.
Ted's appearances on the show spanned over two decades, from the 1980s to the early 2000s. Let's spin the wheel with Ted. Hi, Ted.
Hello.
Welcome to our show.
How you doing today, Ted?
I am doing great. How are you?
Pretty good.
Could you tell our listeners who you are?
My name is Ted Slauson, and I have the distinction of being an Uber Price is Right fan for the first 35 years it was on. And my claim to fame is that I helped a contestant win a showcase in 2008 with a perfect bid on the showcase. I worked for 13 years as a middle and high school math teacher in California. In 2005, moved to Texas, and I've been working in educational assessment. This is, I believe, my 20th year.
You've had quite a history with being a giant fan, a huge fan of The Price is Right. Can you tell us, I guess, about how you started watching The Price is Right, why you're such a huge fan? Just start at the beginning.
Back in the early 1970s, game shows were really just starting to come back from the quiz show scandals that happened in the 50s and 60s. And one show that they revived, which actually was never part of any scandals, was The Price is Right. And they brought it back as The New Price is Right. And the story I always tell, I remember this vividly. I remember where I was sitting in the living room at my parents' house. I was probably seven. I think it was springtime of 1973. And my brothers and sisters and I were all home. I'm the youngest of six. We were sitting in the living room watching TV. And my brothers and sisters, because they're all older, kind of got to make the decision about what we're going to watch. They picked The New Price is Right. And I was just probably rolling my eyes and not wanting to watch the show, but you know, there was nothing else really to do. All my brothers and sisters were going to watch it, so I just sat there and decided I'd watch. And it was funny because I was so wrong about the show. I'd seen commercials and thought it looked boring or stupid or whatever. And after just one episode, I was like, oh, that's a really interesting show. And, you know, it was probably because the stage games, you know, they have to bid on the prizes and contestants row. Then they play a stage game. And then the showcases at the end. I mean, this is way before even the wheel came into play because the show was only half an hour. So that's kind of how I got into it. And then my brother and I started playing The Price is Right. Again, this is before cell phones and apps and all that stuff that you could do, you know, whenever. So we had to kind of make our own fun. And so we would play The Price is Right. And we started to realize when we were watching episodes that we would see prizes that we remembered from other episodes. And it became kind of, not really a contest, but kind of a, wow, that grandfather clock was $1,000 the last time I saw it. And it was $1,000 again today. If you watched every day and you had a good memory, or even if you, you know, maybe not even a great memory, you could still remember some of those things. Back then, I mean, I would, if I was home and I was watching it, I'd have to be scribbling as fast as I could to write down what the prize was and what the price is. And if you missed something, you couldn't rewind and go back. Now, and you know, from the time we got a VCR, you know, then I could at least watch every day and I could rewind if I needed to. And that made a big difference. And then my first home computer, which I have recently gotten working, well, never really stopped working, but I've got it hooked up again. And it's the Texas Instruments TI-99-4A, which was $850. If you want to watch an old episode of The Price is Right, then it dropped to $525. When I started learning how to program, which was basically self-taught because it comes with a manual that I could actually pull it down and show it to you. I started, like, I'd get magazines that would have basic programs and I'd, you know, put them in the computer and play them. And if I liked them, I'd save them to a cassette. And then I started realizing I can write some of my own. And I started writing some of the pricing games from The Price is Right. But I started using some of the prizes and prices from the show. The more I did them, the more kind of advanced it got in terms of pulling stuff from the actual show into these games. And I think that also helped with the memorization, because I actually wrote one of the programs is the showcases. And so it has like a data file basically in the program of this prize, here's the description, here's the price, here's another prize, description, price. And it would pull prizes from those, from that set of data, and you would have to add up the prices. And so it was, I was getting showcases on the nose back then. And the way I got it is I knew three of the prices, and I guessed on the fourth price, which was carpeting. And I guessed based on something my brother had once said, that the carpeting is like $20 per square yard. And it was 25 square yards. So I figured, well, that's probably like $500. Well, it was exactly $500. And I got it on the nose. And it shocked me that I got it on the nose. So, I mean, that feeling for me wore off in the 80s. And so these people who are like, oh my God, you got a showcase on the nose. It's like, yeah, but I've done it forever. It's like, it's not even exciting anymore. Obviously, it was when it happened in the studio. That was a fun day for me, not so much for the show. But, and then over the years, I started going to tapings, and I was able to start helping people win prizes because I didn't get picked for quite a while, even after being on the show. Eventually, I started going back again with friends and family members who wanted to go. And then they changed the eligibility rules in season 37. And that was the impetus for me going in September of 2008 to a taping. And I was uber prepared with all the records that I'd kept and the programs that I had written to help me kind of memorize all the prices.
For people who are not from the U.S., or for people who live under a rock like me, what is The Price is Right? How do you play and how do you win?
The thing that makes The Price is Right interesting, and I think what makes people like it so much, is that the contestants are chosen from the audience. They don't have to go through like a pre-screening testing process. And the only thing you really have to do is go through a brief interview with one of the producers who chooses the contestants prior to the taping. And so you don't know if you're even going to be a contestant until your name is called, or if your name is not called, which is way more likely. And so during the opening of the show, they'll do a little blurb about, here comes the fabulous Price is Right. It, you know, it changed over the years, obviously. And then they start calling the names of the first four contestants. And that's when the people find out I've been selected to play. And so they run down to contestants row. They're told to come on down. That's the big catchphrase. And then, of course, the host is announced, and that was Bob Barker for 35 years. And so the way the game is played is they show a prize. It could be, you know, a refrigerator, dishwasher, a brass bed. It could be any number of things, things that people might go out and buy for themselves. And each contestant gets a chance to make a bid on what they think the prize is worth, the actual retail price of the prize. And the person who bids closest without going over wins the prize and gets to play a game up on stage. And they were, at the beginning, there were only five games that they played. And over the course of the first few years, they increased the number of games to like 7 and then 9 and 11. And it just kind of kept growing and growing. And occasionally they would introduce a game, they'd play it for a while, and they'd realize it didn't really work, or it wasn't really well liked amongst the staff. And so they retire it and then bring in a new game. And at the end of the show, when it was a half hour, it was the two contestants out of the three who got up on stage and won the most. They would play in the showcase round. And in the showcase round, you're shown set of prizes from usually 3 to 5. In the early days, sometimes it could be 6 or 7. And you would make a bid on the entire showcase, what all the prizes were worth in terms of their actual retail price. Whichever contestant bid closest to their own showcase without going over would win everything in their showcase. And that was kind of the grand finale of the show. And as the years went on, they introduced a rule that if you won the showcase and your difference was less than $100, you would win both showcases. So that gave kind of an incentive to try to bid as close as you could without going over. And then around 1975, they did an experimental week of hour-long shows. And in the hour-long shows, there were 6 rounds of bidding in contestants' row and 6 games on stage. And with 6 games and 2 showcases, that wasn't enough time to fill the entire hour. And so what they had to do is they had to introduce something to use up that extra time. And so what they came up with was the Showcase Showdown. And that's where the three contestants in each half of the show spin the big wheel, and they're trying to get closest to a dollar without going over. And so the numbers on the wheel are in increments of 5 cents, from 5 cents all the way up to a dollar. You spin the wheel one time. If you like your score, you can stop. Or if you want to try to improve your score, you can spin again. And your two spins are added together. But if you go over a dollar, you're out of the game. And so it's a gamble if you want to spin the second time. And they put the contestants in order based on how much they won. So the person who won the most in that half of the show gets the advantage, because they'll get to see what the other two spinners do before they make a decision. And it's not unusual. Probably at least once every other week, you'll see somebody who gets into the Showcase by default because both of the first two contestants go over. And so they get one spin to see if they can get a dollar. And if not, it doesn't matter. They're in the Showcase. If you do get a dollar, they introduced a bonus of $1,000 for that. And then there were special sections on the wheel. You get a bonus spin. You could win more money. You could win $5,000 or $10,000. I believe those amounts have gone up to $10,000 and $25,000 now. And then, of course, we talked about the Showcase. And then just, it was incredible to see the ideas they came up with for some of the games. Some of them are obviously really well thought out, very creative. Some of them were kind of clones of other games, kind of just in a different, you know, same wolf and sheep's clothing, but still different enough where, you know, it made sense to have them both on the show. And I think it was somewhere in the early 80s. I would have to ask, but it got to the point where they could do an entire week's worth of tapings and not repeat a pricing game. So you would see 30 different pricing games during the week. And then the next week, you'd see 30 different pricing games. Some of them might be the same as from the week before. Some of them might be different because they would try to rotate them through. Again, I think the exciting part is that the contestants are chosen from the audience and they have no idea beforehand if they're going to be picked or not. And so that adds that element of excitement.
Yeah, I have like fond memories of like watching the show and just seeing people so excited that they were chosen and like freak out and they run down. Yeah, it's kind of cool.
Ted, you know, you were saying like one of the most exciting parts about the show is that the audience is chosen at random. I see that as traumatizing.
So it's not random. Let me clarify. They do tell you before you're interviewed, if for any reason you do not want to be a contestant, just let us know. And what they do is you have a contestant card underneath your name tag. You've probably noticed the name tags everyone wears. They have a contestant card that you stick underneath that with a big giant number on it. And so let's say my number is 28. And then there's a little stub that you sign that says, I understand the rules of the game and I'm eligible to be a contestant. It's not traumatizing unless you make traumatizing.
You know, what were some of your experiences? Because you've gone, you said 37 times.
Yeah, so my experiences, it was obviously a show that I was interested in going to a taping and maybe even getting to be on the show, and wouldn't that be great? And because my luck tends to be Murphy's Law, I call it Charlie Brown luck because I'm a Peanuts fan, but I always figured, okay, so what if they finally pick me and I'm the last one in contestants row? Well, when you're the person who just gets to contestants row, you have to bid first. And the person who has the advantage is the person who bids last, because they can typically bid $1 over whoever they want. Usually it's the highest bid. And a lot of times that is the right way to go. So I thought, well, how do I increase my chances of getting up on stage if I just have that one chance of bidding? And then I thought, well, we've already, you know, started to notice that prizes repeat and the prices don't change. You know, once in a while they will, but I guess if I know a lot of that stuff, know as many of the prizes and prices, then I've increased my chance of getting on stage should I be that last contestant. And so that was, I always tried to go prepared, knowing as much as I could. And then what happens is when you're not chosen, you have all this knowledge in your head and you don't want to keep it to yourself because they encourage you to yell out prices. They encourage you to help people. And so that's what I would do. And for the first six or seven tapings, I was yelling stuff out and people weren't hearing me, or people weren't, you know, they would go with somebody else's bid. And even the very first taping, the very first item up for bids was a swimming pool that I knew was $14.99. And after they described the pool table and the contestants started to bid, a couple people yelled out numbers and then I yelled out $14.99, and everyone bids and Bob says actual retail price, $1,499. And you can see my friend and me in the way, way back of the row of the studio. And she just snaps her head over to me like, you got that right. And she's the one who quizzed me all the way to Los Angeles on prices. I'm like, and why are you surprised that I got that right? You know that I know most of this stuff. I mean, not everything, but, you know, a good chunk. But that was the first six or seven tapings. And then I got a little obnoxious. I think it was the seventh taping. I was yelling stuff out and someone finally paid attention. Well, and the very last person who got up on stage, I had yelled $4.59 for a dishwasher. She bid $4.50. And when Bob read the price of $4.59, she got obviously excited that she won, but there was almost, you could almost see it in her eyes. Like, I heard that number from the audience. Like, I should listen to whoever that was. And then when she went to play her pricing game, it was one where you had to know the price of this, the smaller of the two prizes. And I only knew the price of the bigger prize. But they announced the total price of the two prizes together. So I just subtracted and figured out the other price, yelled it out, and that's what she said. It was safe cracker. She set the safe to $4.10. She won both prizes. A few minutes later, she ended up in the showcase, and the showcase was super exciting. In my first seven tapings, I think it was three times, there was a showcase with two cars. So what was weird is in those first seven tapings that I went to in the studio, three times they had a showcase with two cars. And that's very uncommon. They don't do that or didn't do that many times during the season. So it was interesting to get to see that three times. And on this day, not only did I know the price of the cars, I think it was a Subaru Jesty, and they were $6,579. They were always $6,579. There was a giant rocking horse that was $1,400. There was a video cassette of the movie Twins, which I figured was $20. There was, yeah, this is how old we're talking. There was a video cassette recorder, which I believe was $430. And there was a giant screen TV. The TV had been, and I'm starting to see this on old episodes, the TV had been $3,500. And when I added all of those prices up, I got like $18,500 and change, and not even that much change. Like $18,500, if my prices were on the nose, would have been super, super close. And Marjorie, who was the contestant, got to choose, and she wanted to bid because of the two cars, obviously. And so I yelled out as loud as I could, $18,500. And Bob says, what do you bid on your showcase? And she said, $18,500. Like, she said it exactly the same way. So I'm like convinced 99.9%. She heard me and she took my bid. And then it was like, watch the second showcase, go to commercial. And I'm sitting there going, oh my God, she might win both showcases. This is going to be awesome. This is the first time I've ever gotten someone to listen to me. She'd get $17,356. I was so mortified.
Yeah, that's rough.
Story of my life. The story of my life. Charlie Brown luck. I finally get someone to help. And so later, that show aired in September. So it was the new season, but it taped in like July, I think, or June. And when I saw the new season, the TV was like $2,349. It had gone down that almost the exact difference between $17,356 and $18,500. I was like, oh, if only I'd known that, she would have had both. So then the very next taping, which was in July, yeah, that was July of 1990. Again, not wanting to be obnoxious, but wanting to help people if I'm not able to be a contestant and put this knowledge to use, they show the first item up for bids and it's a home gym. And I hear the name on the manufacturer and I know it's $1,250. I literally waited till Rod said the last syllable in the description of the home gym. And they were still in the process of switching the camera back to Bob. And I yelled out, $12.50. And I'm in the fourth, fifth row. So it was kind of loud. And Bob stopped in the middle of what he was saying. And he's like, well, there's the first bit of The Price is Right. And everyone starts laughing. And he's like, before one of you even opened your mouths. And he proceeds to say, you know, he always had to explain the rules. That's like part of the show. The first item, they always would have to say, whoever bids closest to the actual retail price without going over wins the prize. And then he says, and you, sir, have no chance of winning. And he points at me. And they had a cameraman aim his camera at me, and they put me on camera. And I was like, oh, no. Not only should he not have said that, he's going to find out in a second that I have that exactly right. And then it's going to become a big thing. And so sure enough, everybody bids. Last person bid $1,200. Bob pulls the card out of the envelope, and his eyebrows shot up, and he goes, he had me stand up before he even read the price. And he said, you'll be happy to know the actual retail price is $1,250. And everyone just went crazy because I had it right. And so the first contestant, he played a game where there were only two prices you had to know, and he got them both. And he won a truck. He played Master Key, and he picked the key for the truck, and he won the truck. And then they came back from, as they came back from commercial, Bob would always talk to the audience, and he came up to the edge of the stage, and he said, well, Theodore, you watch The Price is Right. And I said, every day. And everyone was like cheering. And so he was asking me a few questions. And then the stage manager would always say, would always cue him that they were about to come out of commercial. And he would always say, every taping without fail, he'd go, oh, is it time to smile? And everybody would laugh because it's funny. Because it's interesting to be there and see the models when they're not on camera, because they're not smiling the whole time. They don't have that beautiful smile on all the time. It's for the camera, and rightly so. I mean, I don't know anyone who goes around smiling at everyone. So then the production assistant would come and tell the contestants, okay, stand up because you're going to, we're going to proceed with the show. And then Bob would usually make a joke and say, you three can stand up and make another bad bid and then sit down again. And everybody would laugh at that. Well, one of the contestants, her name was Susan. She had an orange blouse. She was blonde, long blonde hair, very pretty. She turns around to me and mouths the words, help me. And I looked at her and I was just like, yeah, no problem. Well, Bob looked down at her, looked at me, realized that we were, you know, she was communicating with me. It's like 3, 2, 1, cameras come on. And he goes, well, during that commercial message, Susan was just overtly flirting with Theodore. That is how quick he was as a host. He did that in no time. And I just started laughing because I'm part of the joke, but it's hilarious to me. And then he makes this whole thing about their dinner date after the show is going to depend on whether he can get her up on stage. And now I'm like, great, I've got someone who's going to listen to me, and hopefully we can, you know, she can win something great. And they bring down an area rug that I've never seen on the show before. Again, Charlie Brown luck. And you can see me on the tape telling her, I don't know. And I'm like, go for 1,000. Like, I'm signaling 1,000. You can read my lips. She bid $1,450. Bob reads the price, and it was $1,059. And I was shocked that I was that close. I was like, just a guess, but it's fine. So somebody else went up on stage, played the second game. She won all three. It was most expensive, where you just picked the most expensive of the three prizes. She won that. It was, I think, fairly easy setup, but I think I was yelling out which one it was. And so everyone is already looking to me like, what is he saying? And so she won. And so they come back for the next game, or the next prize up for bids, and they bring out these Emmett Kelly figurines. And as soon as I see them, I'm like, those are $6.95. And the new contestant turns around, and I'm about to signal to Susan, and I'm like, oh, she's going to bid first. And I don't want her to bid $6.95 because I promised Susan, so I feel like I'm going to wait. So she bids, and I signal to Susan, and she bids $6.95. And the perfect bid bell starts ringing, which means somebody has it exactly right. And no one is surprised when it's Susan. And Bob, of course, then turns it into this whole, well, is dinner tonight going to be separate checks, or are you paying? And she's like, I'll pay. And he makes another joke, and for whatever reason, I'm blanking on this, but... they go to show, he says, here's the prize you can win. They open the doors and it's a big screen TV, and they had my face on the big screen TV. They'd usually put the contestant on just so you could see their reaction with the prize and they wouldn't have to switch the cameras. But no, because it's today, it's my face. And so that was funny. And I heard the name of the TV, that is the manufacturer, and I knew it's 3900. The turntable spins around and it's check game. And she's got to write a check so that when it's added to the price of the TV, it's between $5,000 and $6,000. So I know, because not only do I know the price, I'm a math person and I can subtract in my head. I'm like, it's got to be 2100. She'll max out. It'll be an exciting moment. So you can see me signaling to her 2100. And at some point she realizes, and the contestant or the audience is telling her, she never got her money for her perfect bid. And so that was a whole, Bob had to stop then and pull the money out for her. So the only thing I can think is when she wrote the check for 3,000, she must have figured the TV was 2,100, not the check should be 2,100. And then that would have given her a win. And then when they showed the price and she was over, Bob says, well, maybe Theodore will leave the tip. And they put me on camera and I'm like waving him off like, this is not my fault. No. And they go to commercial. Bob comes down to the stage and he says, well, Theodore, what happened there? And everybody just started yelling at him. And he was like shocked. And he's looking around. He's like, what happened? Who, what? And somebody's like, he told her to write the check for $2,100. And he goes, well, what was the price of the TV? And they were like, $3,900. He goes, well, that would have been $6,000. And I think he even said, Susan, why didn't you write the check for $2,100? And then when they came back and she spun the wheel, he redeemed me, because he did. He said, I was talking with the audience and Theodore told her to write that check for $2,100. You would have been exactly right. So she, obviously, she, and then she had the worst two spins. She spun a nickel on the first spin, which is the worst you can spin. She spins again and hits a dollar and goes over by 5 cents. I was like, it just was not her day. And after the showcase showdown, Bob kind of didn't mention me as much on camera, or mention me as much. But I did manage to get one more kind of cameo during the last game, which was the card game, which they play for a car. And the car in the game was the same car I had seen the previous taping. And the reason I knew the price was they had played Lucky 7, and the contestant got the first number on the nose, got the second number on the nose, got the third number on the nose, and then he won. He started yelling this price, and Bob goes, well, Theodore's still out there, isn't he? And so the contestant basically played the game, but she ended up at 7,700. She went a little over what I had said. But then I was wrong. It was actually $8,694. And when they went to commercial, Bob explained that the reason that because the producer had come over and talked to him briefly. And he said, Roger just told me that there is a model of that car that's $7,659. But we put different options on them to fool people like you. And everybody started laughing. And of course, my brain is like, oh, so when the new season starts, I need to start tracking car options, because that way I can start doing a better job with cars.
Of course.
Because there were only certain cars, like I said, that Subaru Justy, the Toyotas were always like the same price. But anything else, I think they would do that where they would change out the options and it would cause things to be completely different. But so that was kind of the one that made me famous. And then after that, I mean, I went back 16 times before they picked me. And every time the producer during the interview would welcome me back, and he knew me. I mean, they remembered me every single time. And I helped people win almost, I would say, of those 16, I would say probably 13 or 14 times I helped at least one person win. And one of my favorites was a contestant who played One Away, which is where there's a fake price for the car and all the numbers and the real price are either one up or one down from the price. and he was playing for the Toyota Celica. And the Toyota Celica was always, it had been 14,043, but it had changed to 14,143. And I'm in the front row, so I'm right there, and I'm trying to yell and scream, and he's looking, and his grandmother, who he's with, is on the other side of the front row. They were in the front row also, but they're on the other side, so he was probably looking at her. And he gets all the numbers, and Bob asks for the, you know, is, do I have at least one number right? And they sound the horn. Do I have at least two numbers right? They sound the horn. Do I have at least three numbers right? There's nothing, because he's made the price 15,000. 345, I think, was what he did, or 15,001 something. So Bob asks him which number you want to change. He changes the one number. So now he's got 15,145. So both his fives are wrong. Those are the two numbers I know he needs to change. And the audience thinks they're right. They think a Toyota Celica is a $15,000 car in 1991. Bob says, what other numbers do you want, or what other number do you want to change? Or what's another number you want to change? I don't know why, but Alec, that was the contestant's name, he looked right at me and I went, change the five. And he turned to Bob and he goes, and he kind of giggled. He's like, I'll change the five. And Bob looks at the price and he goes, the first five or the second five? And I was like, both of them. And I'm like pointing like this and nodding vigorously. And he turns, that's what he giggled. He turns to Bob and he's like, both of them? And so Bob flips the fives and turns them into threes. The audience is screaming no. They are convinced he has lost the car. And frankly, it was probably set up for him to lose the car because everyone thought it was 15,000. When they showed the first number and it was a one, no one's surprised. They showed the three and you can hear the audience just go, whoa, like no one was expecting it except me to be a three. And then he did all the other numbers. He won the car. He ended up in the showcase. He won a second car, not because he listened to me, but he walked out of there with like a Toyota Celica and a Pontiac Firebird or something, like two
That's
really
insane.
Nice sports cars. Yeah,
that's crazy. That was a crazy one.
I'm curious to know, what category of products do you feel like you've always or almost always got right? And what category do you feel like you've had a hard time guessing the price of?
Grocery items and the main prizes, I would say I was the most accurate. I could never do trips.
So, you know, you've like spent time memorizing these prices. How is that even possible?
I would challenge anyone who knows this story to go watch the Bob Barker era shows that they're running on like Pluto TV and the Roku channel. And it's on, I forget how many places it's on now. You'll see some of the stuff and you'll start noticing, oh yeah, they just had that bar set, or, oh yeah, I remember seeing that bar globe, the bar globe, $560. What was scary to me is when I started watching those shows and I still remembered some of the prices from way back in 1982. It's like, how is that even still up there? And how did I access it? There's a yellow and white bar set. And when I saw it, I have a friend who yellow is her favorite color. And so I think I took a picture of it and I sent it to her and I'm like, look, they have a prize that you'll like on The Price is Right. You know, it's from 1982, but whatever. And something in my head was like, this has a weird price. It's like, I don't know, something like $782. And Bob read the price and it was $782. And I was like, where did that even come from? How do I still know this? Because, I mean, those are long gone. Like, I shouldn't still remember that stuff. But back then, it wasn't as hard because they didn't have as many things in the rotation as they did later. And I think it's because as the show gained popularity and because, you know, it went on into, you know, 10 seasons and then 15 seasons and then 20 seasons, they were adding in more and more games. In 1990, they had, I think, almost 60 games. It was definitely over 50.
Ted, you seem to have a really good memory, which is way better than anything I could ever remember. Recalling prices would be, for me, like trying to get close because I kind of know like what the price should be for certain items, but it seems like you literally were just like out of nowhere remembering numbers.
Yep. Sometimes. And it, like I said, I think that was that visual aspect. Yeah. Early on, it was you'd see the show. You got to remember in the 70s and up to probably 82, 83, we didn't have a VCR. So if you didn't see the show, you didn't see the show. Back then, I mean, I would, if I was home and I was watching it, I'd have to be scribbling as fast as I could to write down what the prize was and what the price is. And if you, again, if you missed something, you couldn't rewind and go back. Now, from the time we got a VCR, you know, then I could at least watch every day and I could rewind if I needed to. And that made a big difference.
You know, I'm curious to know how they decide on the prices. Is it Los Angeles, you know, during that time period? Because, you know, it does depend on where you are in the world and the time.
So in the beginning, I mean, I think most everything was sponsored by the manufacturers. And so the manufacturer would tell them, here's what the suggested retail price is for this prize. Here's what the suggested retail price is for this prize. So I don't know if the manufacturers would have to like keep the show updated when they change their prices, or if the show would contact the manufacturers whenever they used their prizes and kind of see if there were any changes. But prices went up here and there, and that was in the early days. And then with cars, they would get them from local dealerships. Like you would see a smallish number. It got bigger over the years, but there might be like, I don't know, 15 or 20 cars that you would see regularly on the show. And those are the kind where they throw in different options, so they weren't always the same price. Grocery items and small prizes were generally sponsored. But a lot of things, I think now with the internet too, if you know, there was something they wanted to use as a prize, they could probably just look up the price on the internet and go with that price, I would think.
Any price that still shocks you to this day?
There was a trailer. It wasn't like a gigantic, I mean, it was kind of a long trailer, maybe a 22 foot or something. It was like $28,000. That to me seemed kind of high.
So speaking of like the showcase and all that, you know, in the documentary, obviously, talk about the perfect showcase that happened in 2008. So if you could tell us just a little bit about that.
In 2007, they changed the eligibility rules for being a contestant on The Price is Right. So they changed the rules and said, if it's been more than 10 years since you were a contestant, you can be on again. So I was like, oh, well, I'm going to be there. I flew to LA and got a rental car. You know, went to bed as early as I possibly could because I knew I wanted to get in line early. I got up, showered, got dressed, went over. There were only three people in line. There was an older couple. Their names were Norbert and Francis. And about an hour went by. I was chatted maybe a little bit with Norbert and Francis. And a guy, Terry, walked up. We're all kind of talking because it's getting closer to the time where they're going to open the gates and start giving us our numbers and stuff. Let us into the studio. We're sitting in the front row. Warm up. The tape starts and you can see the monitors and we're all clapping and they start calling the names, and Terry was the third name called. So Terry runs up to contestants row and they announce Drew Carey. So he welcomes everyone. They show the first item and it's a sailboat. And the sailboat had been $35.95. So I'm telling Linda, and the price actually had gone up to $36.95. So somebody else won, went up on stage, and he won a car. Second item. Now, Linda has told Terry, Ted knows prices. He only missed that sailboat like by $100. We should listen to him. And so they get up to bid on the next thing. And of course, Charlie Brown Luck. It's a new camera, and it's a camera that has not been on the show during season 36. So I have no clue. And the cameras that were on were like in the $500 range. I don't know what we told Terry or if he took a bid from us. But somebody else won, went up on stage, and he played It's in the Bag for $16,000. And the way the game works is there's bags, and each bag has a price. There's five bags, but there's six products, and you have to put a product with each bag. And if you pick the product that's actually in each bag that has that price, you win $1,000, then $2,000, then $4,000, then $8,000, then $16,000. Linda and I, front row, were yelling, three of those items that she rattled off in line are in the game, and they have the prices that she mentioned. So I know she knows her stuff, at least with grocery items. We're yelling, we're telling the guy, He got all five on the nose. Problem is, he doesn't know that. And the excitement of the game is that every time they show you one of the products, do you have the choice? Do you want to take the money or do you want to go on and see the next one? But if you miss the next one, you're going to lose all your money. So it's that whole, you know, all or nothing thing. He stopped at the third bag with $4,000. And Linda and I were like, no, go all the way. We're like literally yelling at him, go all the way. And so then Drew shows the last two and he could have won the 16. But, you know, I'm sure he was happy with his 4,000. So they go to commercial, they come back, and the next item up for bids is the Big Green Egg Smoker Barbecue. But the Big Green Egg had been $900 for quite a few years, and it had recently gone up that season to $1,175. So we signaled that to Terry using our fingers. He likes to claim that he, you know, he has a hearing problem, and so if people were yelling things, I couldn't hear them. It's like, yeah, but you could see my hands going 1175. So he bids $1,175. The perfect bid bell goes off. He goes up on stage and he plays the game Switch. And there are two prizes. Actually, there were three. But the one prize was a pair of exercise bikes. And the other prize was a personal computer. And you have to decide if the prices on the prizes are already correct or if you should switch them. From where I was sitting, I don't know. I didn't see the S on exercise bikes. Like, I saw exercise bike, and I think I was too focused on the prices because it was like, I don't know that I know either of these, and I want to at least help him make a right decision. Well, the price on the exercise bikes was like $3,644, and the price on the computer was $2,849. And from what I knew, I'm like, well, that nine at the end of that price seems like it's logical for an exercise bike. And that 3644 weird number is probably the computer, because the computers always had weird numbers because, you know, they'd add a printer or they'd add more memory or they had, the computers were almost like trips. They were very hard to keep track of. So Linda and I both agree we're going to switch. So we're telling him switch. This is the only time they put me on camera, by the way, the time I'm wrong. We're telling him switch. So he switches the prices and he loses. And we're like, oh, that's weird. So then when I get home, I realized, oh, it was two exercise bikes. How did I miss that? I knew the price of one of them, which ended with 49. And then the other one was like a 995, which made the 44 at the end. I'm like, okay, well, now it makes sense, but it's too late. So now it's time to spin the wheel. Terry's the first spinner because he's the only one who didn't really win his pricing game. And he gets 90 cents. And so Linda and I are like, this is awesome. He's a good chance of going to the showcase. Other two people didn't beat him. So now we're like, this is great. Terry's in the showcase. And they go to the second half of the show. And the fifth game was One Away, which we talked about already. But the contestant got up on stage. Her name is Sharon. And I think at one point, Linda had probably said, you should listen to Ted. He knows the prices of a lot of stuff. And so the price to bid on was the cherry red washer and dryer, which was $2,598. It's the only red washer and dryer on, but you can see me telling her $2,598. When it gets to her, she's the last bidder. Somebody bid $2,200. That's the highest bid. So she said $2,201. Drew reads the price. It's $2,598. She spun around and looked at me because I'm sitting right there and just got so excited and went up on stage. And Drew shows her the car and it's the Pontiac Vibe. Well, there was only one logical price and it was $18,546 because $18,566 would be a repeating number, which they never do. So I was like, she's going to get this on the first guess. And she's looking at me on every number and I'm signaling, and she'd walk away from Drew so she could see me around the camera. She won the car on the first shot. She had all five numbers right. She was very excited. And she also ended up in the showcase with Terry. So it's time for the showcases. They took the three contestants who didn't get out of contestants row and they had them model the three prizes in the showcase because they were going to give the models a break. And so the three contestants are doing the modeling and it's the VocoPro Sonic Station karaoke machine. So I'm like, okay, the big tower, it's like a big giant computer, it looked like. That is going to remind me that's a one. And that one is going to help me remember it's 1,000. 1,000, because it's easy. I kept wanting to make it some weird number. So I knew that one. The next prize is a pool table, and the last prize is the 17-foot Hilo travel trailer, which is the one that goes up and down. Yeah, the top goes down over the bottom. I start adding this all up, but I got the number, and I said to Linda, that showcase is $23,743. Sharon passes the showcase to Terry. So Terry's looking at Linda and me. We're signaling with our fingers. Then he just says, $23,743. And they light up the bid, and Drew says, wow, that's a very exact bid. He then tells Sharon, here's your showcase. Her showcase is every trip in the house. So then they finish the trip showcase. Sharon bids $30,575. But while this is happening, I'm watching what's happening on stage. And Kathy Greco, she started out as like a production assistant, I think. She became associate producer. Then she's just become producer. In this new season. So she's worked on the show forever. She's got her clipboard that she carries around. She's like taking records. She used to track, I think, like every bid in contestants. It's crazy the stuff they tracked. But she just kind of turned and walked casually over to this area. And it was a wall that had a screen in it. Like you could raise the screen, but you could also, I guess it was kind of see-through. And she just stared into that screen. Why would she be standing there? You know, obviously communicating with somebody back there about something. Like I knew then that he had it. And so then they finished the trip showcase. Sharon bids $30,575. You know, Drew says, we'll be right back. And the lights go off and the monitors go out. And
they essentially stopped the show then for a little bit.
I thought the stop down was 15 to 20 minutes. So during the stop down, I did notice when Kathy walked over to Drew, she was kind of face to face with him. They were kind of not quite backstage, but kind of around the corner. From where the turntable is. And I could tell he was trying hard to keep a poker face. Like he had a smile on his face, but it was like a WTF kind of smile. And that was her telling him he got that showcase on the nose. And I think what they had to have, standards and practices, probably help them make a decision about what do we do? Can this be considered cheating? Drew's attitude coming back into the taping was less than pleasant because he's now paranoid that he's going to lose his job over this perfect showcase bid on a show that's called The Price is Right, I might add. Drew starts reading and he goes to the top winner, Sharon, and he says, you bid $30,525 on your showcase. Actual retail price, $31,019. And now I'm feeling really bad because on her own, she's missed her showcase by just under $500. And so then he steps over to Terry and he says, Terry, you have the trailer, the jukebox, you bid $23,743. And he kind of chuckles a little and he goes, actual retail price, $23,743. You got it right on the nose. And I look up and there's a camera right on stage, right in front of me. And it's pointed at Linda. And I leaned over and I said, by the way, you're on camera. And she's like, what? And we're clapping along. And I look up and now the camera's pointed at me. It's the end of the show. He's won. Linda goes up on stage. Terry had won and Linda had just won his showcase. Drew and takes Terry and Linda with the models and they go look at the prizes. And after the show went off, Linda came back down. Terry had asked Drew to autograph Linda's shirt. And so that's what happened. She went up, Drew autographed her shirt, she came back down. They did the door prize drawing, which they do at the end of every show, and the audience files out. And so we all left. And again, I'm shocked that they haven't like pulled me aside and said, who do you think you are? What are you doing? And we go outside and they're announcing that they have tickets for the second show. And I'm thinking, you know, I don't have to be in Sacramento tomorrow. Or, you know, I was probably going to drive up that night, but I thought there's no reason I can't stay for the other show and we'll see how it goes when I get in there. And so I get in line or I get my my pass and or my contestant number, and I sign my stub and everything. Well, the contestants from the show that had just taped are coming out one at a time. They've got their cue cards if they were one of the first four. And then Terry comes out, and I can't remember if Linda stayed in there with him or if she came out with him. And then, but everyone, there were a lot of people who went to the second taping, and they were congratulating Terry. And Linda kind of separated herself from the group, and she motioned me over or called me over. We're probably about 10 feet away from this group that was congratulating Terry. And I walked over and I said, you know, what's up? And she's like, we just wanted to say thank you and we want you to keep in touch with us.
You know, a lot of people are always kind of wondering what their legacy is going to be. And I guess you kind of have one.
This is mine. Yep.
For the documentary, how was that experience of having a documentary filmed about your experiences?
It was interesting because it wasn't supposed to be a documentary. And the filmmaker had contacted me way back in 2010. And that's when Esquire magazine did the article about The Perfect Bid. And they interviewed Terry and they interviewed me and they interviewed Drew. And the interviewer, we did a phone interview. He was just enthralled, I guess, is a good word, by the whole story, because I had obviously so much to tell. And the way he wrote the article, he didn't come out and say it directly. There's like a very subtle hint at the ending of the article, which I just think is hilarious. It was really, really well written. So CJ Wallace got this, his parents actually got him the magazine for his birthday, I think specifically because of that story, because he's had something similar happen to him. So he contacted me either on Facebook and he said, hey, I'm interested in doing a movie loosely based on this incident. Would you be willing to be like a on-set paid whatever? I can't remember the term. And I said, sure. And in my head, I'm thinking, like, this is ever going to happen. Like, whatever. I'll say yes, but I'm not going to start counting my money because this, you know, may or may not happen. And then it was, I think it was 2016 or very early in 2017 when he said, okay, I've got the funding. I've got the funding set up and I'm ready to move forward. And he said, can you send me the story of like your experiences? And it's 14 pages long too. Because it's, you know, it's got it specifics and stuff from different tapings. And messaged back, he goes, wow. He's like, I don't think I'm going to do my story. It was going to be a fictitious game show. But he goes, your story is way better. He's like, I'm just going to make a documentary. I was like, okay. And again, I'm like, and you know, when is this going to happen? Because, you know, we've already waited this long. So then in 2017, he started asking, I think for some, I can't remember if I sent him video clips before or after we filmed, but he basically, they flew me up to Vancouver on Memorial Day weekend. We filmed the first segment Saturday night. Second day, we filmed in the afternoon. I think there's a part in that documentary where he spliced the third day. So Memorial Day, we went to the, I think it's the Pyatt Music Hall, which was just down the street from where I was staying. And that's it looks kind of like the Bob Barker studio used to, which is why he wanted to use it. It's got like the red seats. I think he used mostly that day's stuff, but so it was 3 days of filming. Not a lot. I mean, literally all told, maybe 6-7 hours that it was me talking, and not a lot. I mean, he had me tell the same story, obviously, a couple different times, but I flew home. But that was a lot of fun. My parents got to see it early. They got to see it at Christmas time in 2017, which is before it got released, which was May of 2018. It actually got released on their anniversary. So I was home for Christmas and CJ had like uploaded a version for me to show them. And I got to show them one night. My brother and his partner were there. So that was a nice thing. And my mother's comment was, well, it was good, but does he have to use that word so much? Meaning Drew and his F-bombs. Because we saw people at screenings at film festivals who, that when that happened, you know, about the second or third F-bomb, they would get up and leave because it, you know, was really offensive to them. But wow. It's also, I mean, it's how he speaks. If you saw him talking about this event on the game show, they bleeped him every time. And it's like, does he not have other words he can use? Like, is that the go-to word?
I mean, some people curse for emphasis. That's some people just, I don't know. And it's funny because my last question for you was going to be, are you banned from the show?
Yeah, that depends who you ask. I was told, I was told early on from, again, the website that, you know, it was all about The Price is Right. There's more than one, but the one I was a member of. One of the more, he's now a moderator, I think. He actually messaged me and said, there's a short list of names at CBS, and the pages have been instructed that if they see those names as they're going through the line, because they check your ID as part of the process. When they do your name tag, they take your first name straight off your ID. If they see those names, they're supposed to notify security immediately. So that to me screams banned, or at least, you know, something's going to happen because they're going to have security come. But then that was 2008, maybe 2009, or so 2017, when the documentary was going through its early stages, and Fremantle said, oh, you have to take that out. There's no banned list. Maybe things changed. But again, you know, that's an awful lot to gamble on, to show up and then find out, you know, I spent months preparing and I can't even go in because they're mad at me still for something that happened 15 years ago almost. So,
Ted, thank you so much for, you know, sharing your story.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank Ted for being on the show today and for sharing his knowledge of The Price is Right.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Bound by the Cloak. Also, don't forget to check out the documentary about Ted's experience on The Price is Right. It's called Perfect Bid, The Contestant Who Knew Too Much. And you can find it on Tubi, Pluto TV, Peacock, Sling TV, the Roku channel, Flex, Amazon Prime Video, YouTube. Honestly, it's everywhere. Go check it out. You can check out reruns of episodes of The Price is Right on Pluto TV. There are channels dedicated to it, which is pretty awesome, and I might be watching those this afternoon. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Good Pods, really wherever you get your podcasts. We're on social media. Find us on X, Instagram, Threads, and TikTok. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode of Bound by the Cloak. Thanks for listening.
Until next time.